minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia on the National Community Radio Satellite. Listen to the Anarchist World This Week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. Listen to analysis of local, national, international events. Listen to analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. My name's Joseph Toscano. This program is coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. Unfortunately, the program is podcast, as I won't be around this week and next week. So, if you want an up-to-date analysis of what's happening, I'm sorry. Occasionally, you've got to take a break. Now, I thought, as I'm not in a position to look at current affairs, I mean, for all I know, the world may have come to an end. Hopefully it hasn't, but you never know these days. I thought I'd talk about Australian trade unionism. 1822 to 2026. And actually see what's happened during these 204 years. Because I think it's critical that we understand what's happened to one of the few organisations which was actually able to resist the dominant institutions. And we've seen a revolution in terms of the ability of the trade union movement to be effective. So I'd like to start off in the beginning. And the first known record of an embryonic trade union movement can be found in the early records of colonisation. In 1822, James Straiter, S-T-R-A-I-T-E-R, if you want to look him up, not much about him, but it's a little bit there. In 1822, James Straiter, a convict who worked for Hannibal MacArthur, not Hannibal Lecter, but the so-called great, you know, Hannibal MacArthur, was charged with the heinous crime of inciting his master's servants to combine to oblige him to increase their wages and rations. I'll go through it again. Inciting his master's servants, and the key word is to combine, to oblige him to increase their wages and rations. Now, theoretically, convicts who were assigned to the squatters were supposed to be paid a minuscule peppercorn wage, but even that wage was never paid, as they had to pay for their board, which basically meant living in a shed. And even their implements and food. Yeah, when I'm talking about implements, I'm talking about a tin can to drink from and maybe a fork. So this is the first example that we know. Maybe there have been examples before, which since 1788, which hadn't been recorded, that we know of. Now, James Straiter was sentenced to 500 lashes in one sitting. 500 lashes with the cat and a nine tail, 500. If he survived the 500 lashes, he was to serve 1 month in solitary confinement, surviving on bread and water. And if he survived that, he was to spend the rest of his penal sentence in a penal colony, which is tantamount to a death sentence. So because he incited his fellow convicts to beg for a few more crumbs, he was sentenced to 500 lashes, 1 month solitary confinement on bread and water, and to spend the rest of his sentence in a penal colony. Extraordinary. This is the first known record of how people who withdrew their labour or attempted to withdrew their labour were treated. Now, in the 1830s and 1840s, we saw more so-called three settlers enter the colony of New South Wales. That's both New South Wales, then covered Victoria as well as New South Wales. And we saw the formation of a number of small embryonic unions for people with skills, like typesetters. Now, these unions came and went. They were basically revolved around the idea of people with skills being able to combine to improve their conditions, because at that particular point in time, if you left your employment, you could be hunted down as a criminal and charged and fined and imprisoned, whether you're a convict or a free settler. If you left your employment because you were badly treated by your employer and you didn't have permission to leave, you were hunted down like a criminal and charged and imprisoned. The next major time that people were able to combine was after the gold rushes. Now, the gold rushes made cities like Melbourne the richest city in the world. And obviously, as cities expand, you needed skilled tradespeople to expand that city. And the stonemasons were the cornerstone of the construction industry. Now, the stonemasons had long associations from the 13th century with the guilds, workers' guilds, which existed for professional tradespeople. And in Australia, the stonemasons formed their own trade unions. The key is trade. And although everybody thinks that the 8-hour day was one in Melbourne, it was actually one a month earlier in Sydney. We're not talking about an 8-hour, 5-day week, but an 8-hour, 6-day week. And the reason they were exceptionally successful is they had a monopoly on the skills that were required to grow the colonies. Now, in Victoria, the stonemasons met at the Golden Fleece Hotel. They made an ultimatum to their employers that they were going to work an 8-hour day and they wanted to be paid the same amount as working a 10-hour day. And if the employers didn't acquiesce within a week, they would walk off the job. And if you look at the historical records at that particular point in time, they walked off the job in Parliament House. They walked off the job at the University of Melbourne. And they walked off the job amongst a number of other public buildings in Melbourne. And within 24 hours, because of their monopoly as stonemasons on the construction industry, and because they combined, they worked together for their common good, they're actually able to achieve what they wanted. Now, skilled workers around the colonies were in a position to use their skills and their monopoly on skills, especially skills which were fundamental to the expansion of the colonial empire, to improve their condition. And it's interesting, the first person, the first worker elected to a official position was the member for Collingwood. I've forgotten his name, but he had a great saying. He says, "During the day, I break rocks, and during the night, I break Tories." So that was a great saying, but I'm sure you'll remember who it was, or you can find out. First elected member who actually represented working people, and that was in the division of Collingwood. Now, the trade union movement ebbed and flowed, and it wasn't until the industrial age and the formation of factories, especially in the 1880s and 1890s, that we saw an extension of the trade union movement from trades to labour. We saw a huge influx of semi-skilled and unskilled workers into the trade union movement. And the Trade Union Council changed its name to the Trade Union and Labour Council, acknowledging the fact that unskilled and semi-skilled workers were becoming unionised, banding together to improve their particular situation. In the 1880s, in Melbourne, we saw the evolution and formation of the first women's trade union, and that was a tailoress union, which was quite a radical union. Now, the problem that you have between unskilled work or semi-skilled work and people who are skilled artisans is the fact that there is always ways to break a strike of unskilled and semi-skilled workers by paying strike breakers, blacklegs, whatever you like to call them, to take the jobs of people who remove their labour, who are semi-skilled or unskilled. So it's very difficult for semi-skilled and unskilled workers to actually achieve goals. And the only way they could do that is by preventing scab labour from taking their jobs. And obviously there's always confrontations at the factory gate where scabs were attacked for a variety of reasons. But the great strikes we saw during this period is in the 1870s, the Maritime Strike, which was eventually defeated, and the Great Shearers Strike, which encompassed Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. The shearer strike failed after about 2 years' struggle. And it didn't fail because of divisions within the union. It failed because the state began to fight back. Jail and jail union leaders for encouraging people to withdraw their labour, and for using direct action as a tactic by which to keep scabs out of the wool sheds. So we see a protracted struggle during this period where the states used military force, because each colony had its own military divisions, to try to break the strikes by jailing organisers and strike leaders. The failure of the maritime strike in the 70s and the Shearer strike in the 1890s, early 1890s, led to the formation of the Australian Labor Party. And it's interesting that within 20 years of the formation of the Australian Labor Party, an Australian Labor government was elected under Mr. Watson. It was only there for a few months, but it was actually a federal Labor government was elected. But that's another story we can look at. So the trade union movement was linked to the Australian Labor Party. And what we saw with the outbreak of World War I was the first major split in the trade union movement. And that split was on the question of conscription. Now, Billy Hughes, the Labor Prime Minister of this country, in 1915, a Labor Prime Minister, was very keen to increase the number of people that had volunteered to join the 420,000 Australian volunteers that had become involved in World War One. Now, as you know, World War One was basically a war which was fought by workers at either end of a bayonet. And those of you who attend Anzac Day ceremonies and are told that World War One was about liberty and freedom, crap. World War One was a war about God, King, and country. It's about duty. And although conscription was introduced in many European countries, the trade union movement was very keen to resist conscription. All sections were. Now, Billy Hughes, under pressure from the English government to increase the number of Australian men to be slaughtered on the European killing fields, split the Labor Party in 1916, crossed the floor with one third of the members, and joined the opposition National Party, and continued to be Prime Minister. Then he held a referendum. He was concerned about a general strike because of the strength of the trade union movement amongst workers and obviously the influence the industrial workers of the world were having on the trade union movement with their anti-conscription stance, and called a referendum for December 1916 to introduce conscription. To his chagrin, the Australian people, in the midst of World War One, despite the hysteria that was going on, edged on by the women's movement, the trade union movement, and Archbishop Mannix of the Roman Catholic Church, an Irish nationalist, defeated the conscription referendum. But the blow that had been dealt to the Labor Party was quite long-standing. Billy Hughes again in 1917 attempted to introduce conscription and once again failed to introduce conscription. Now, around this country, you'll see monuments to the 62,000 young Australian men. That's almost 15% of the volunteers who went across to Europe to fight, who died on the European killing fields. But you will see no monuments to a group of Australians which included the bulk of the trade union movement, who were involved in anti-conscription referendums, which resulted in Australians, young Australian men, not being sent to be sacrificed on the European killing fields for the glory of God, King and country. Now, a trade union movement continued to grow in the 1920s. The Depression, which began in 1929, and to many Australian authorities, which continued to the beginning of World War II, was a difficult time for the trade union movement. It was a difficult time because there were a lot of unemployment was up to 25% in some areas. So people would do anything for a job. And so the ability to withdraw your labour became much more difficult in a period where there is an excess number of people who are unemployed. So it wasn't till the late 1930s that we saw the re-emergence of a strong trade union movement. In a significant degree, this had occurred because the Communist Party of Australia was able, through elections, to dominate the executive of many of the major unions in this country. Now, what we saw in the late 30s, because of the domination, especially of the maritime workers, what we saw in the late 1930s was trade unions taking on a more expansive role. They were not just interested in the conditions and wages of their members. They saw themselves as part of Australian society. And what we saw as the drums of war were reverberating around the country, what we saw was the Maritime Union of Australia and the dock workers introducing bans on sending iron ore to Japan because they were concerned about the Japanese intervention in Korea and China and the growth of a fascist movement in Japan. So we saw trade unions moving out of their traditional role of protecting wages and conditions and expanding wages and conditions of their workers in the late 1930s. Obviously, during World War II, trade unionism took a backward step. Unlike World War I, where there was a general strike in 1917, in the midst of the war, production and the fact that Australia was at the mercy of a possible major invasion by the Japanese Imperial Forces, we saw the trade union movement work behind the war effort. And on top of that, the Communist Party of Australia, which was basically Stalinist, when the Führer invaded Russia, and Stalin threw his lot in behind the Allies, we saw the Communist Party of Australia throw its lot in behind the Labor government during World War II to support the war effort and the fight against fascism and Nazism. At the end of World War II, what we saw was an influx of servicemen and women, many who had been prisoners of war of the Japanese, to a lesser extent of the Germans, demanding a reward for their sacrifices. Many of these people were proud trade unionists. And that reminds me of the great struggle in the 1920s on the Melbourne wharves, where an Anzac veteran was shot dead by police when he was involved in some militant action on the wharves to protect their wages and conditions just before the Great Depression, but that's another story. So we've got the trade union movement beginning to re-emerge from the slumber of World War II as people demanded rewards for the sacrifices they had made, demanded rewards for the 25,000 Australian men and women that have been killed during World War II. In the trade union movement, there was a struggle going on in the 50s and 60s, and those of you old enough will remember the struggle that the Catholic Church, concerned about the godless communist influence in the trade union movement, set up its own attempts to take over certain unions, and Mr. Santa Maria, who was supported heavily by the Murdoch media, was the leading light. So in many regards, in the late 50s and early 60s, the trade union movement was on its back foot because it had been infiltrated by Catholic militants who were attempting, in a McCarthy-like push, to oust the Communist Party from sections of the trade union movements which they had a stranglehold over. It wasn't till the late 70s, sorry, it wasn't until the early 60s and late 60s and early 70s that we saw the emergence of a new trade union movement, which I'm intensely interested in. And that was spearheaded by the Sydney branch of the Builders Labourers Federation. And three names which appear over and over again in the historical record: Bob Prinkle, Joe Owens, and the third one, the most important, I've forgotten, believe it or not, but it'll come to me. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. So in 1968, the once proud Builders Labourers Federation division in New South Wales had been taken over by criminals, and corruption was a byword. A proud union which had been established in 1911 to look after the interests of concreters and scaffolders and dogmen and riggers, semi-skilled and unskilled workers, had become a cesspool of corruption and criminality. And in 1968, a new leadership emerged. And this leadership talked about unionism and social responsibility. Believe it or not, unionism and social responsibility. They believed that the role of the union should not just be about protecting the wages and expanding the rights of their members, but they were part of a wider community and they should interact with the wider community. And the three major figures were Jack Mundy, Joe Owens, and Bob Prinkle. Now, Jack Mundy and Joe Owens were members of the Communist Party of Australia. Bob Pringle was a member of the Australian Labor Party. There was a huge division amongst the communist world in the early 1970s. There was the Communist Party of Australia Marxist-Leninist, which had a Maoist orientation, and the Communist Party of Australia in New South Wales, which was influenced by the Euro-communisms, which is basically based on the writings and ideas of Antonio Gramsci. The Euro-communism was basically evolved as a result of the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968, and it was branded as communist with a human face. Now, interestingly, as far as the Builders' Labourers' Federation was concerned, the Communist Party of Australia Marxist-Leninist under Norm Gallagher were able to take over the Victorian branch, which is also the federal branch, while the Euro-Communists took over the New South Wales branch in 1968. Now, a lot of people equate the New South Wales branch of the BLF as basically green bands. Well, the term green bands wasn't introduced till 1973. And the first environmental protection which occurred, green or black band it was called, didn't occur in Sydney, as everybody assumes, but occurred regarding a park in Carlton which was going to be developed, where the Melbourne-based Builders' Labourers' Federation put a black ban on work on that particular Carlton park. But the ideas that the New South Wales BLF was attempting to implement were much, much, much more radical than anything the Federal Builders' Labourers Federation had even considered. They talked about internal democracy. Decisions, although they had 11,000 members across New South Wales, mainly in Sydney, decisions were made by mass meetings. Internal democracy was fundamental to the success of the Builders' Labourers' Federation. Almost 100 members of the Communist Party of Australia, the Euro-Communists, were actually part and parcel of the New South Wales BLF. They were interested in paying, well, they only paid their officials award wages. But they saw themselves not just as unionists fighting for their members' rights and wages. They saw themselves as a wider responsibility. It was called unionism, social responsibility. So here we have the unskilled and the semi-skilled, the riggers, the dogmen, the concreters, the scaffolders. And dogmen aren't what you think they are. Dogmen, I was a dogman for a short period of time, were people who basically rode on steel girders directing the crane where to put down the steel. Obviously, you don't have dogmen these days. It was outlawed years ago. So here we have a corrupt, criminal-based organisation transformed almost overnight into an organisation which was based on internal democracy, mass meetings, limited tenure for officials, award wages for officials, who understood they were part and parcel of society. And the leadership of that union understood that to be part and parcel of that society, you need to be involved in the activities, the social and political activities of the day. Now, although 42 green bands were introduced by the New South Wales BLF, and those of you who, you know, don't live in Sydney and visit Sydney may not be aware that low-income suburbs like Woolloomooloo, Redfern, the Rocks, you know, the first European colonisation settlements in Australia would have been demolished and office blocks would have been built. Botanic Garden, Centennial Park, and the list goes on and on. And so how did it all begin? In 1971, Jack Mundy was approached by a small group of women, 13 to be exact, regarding the struggle around Kelly's Bush. Now, Kelly's Bush was the only undeveloped part of Sydney Cove. It was privately owned, but the person who bought Kelly's Bush and erected a smelter had left the majority of the land to be enjoyed by the local community. That's right. The majority of the land to be enjoyed by the local community. When the smelter shut down in 1966, what we saw is that A.V. Jennings bought Kelly's Bush and wanted to develop it for luxurious homes. Now, a small group of women fought back, and they used every legal means at their disposal. They fought the local council but lost. They approached the state government and lost. And eventually, they approached the New South Wales Builders Labourers Federation for assistance. Now, Jack Mundy and Joe Owens and Bob Pringle, who are members of the executive of the BLF at that particular point in time, saw that their struggle was not just about members' rights and conditions. They understood there was a wider social struggle. And they said to the committee which had been set up to save Kelly's Bush, they said, organise a public meeting. If there is significant support, we will place a black ban on the development of Kelly's Bush. They organised a public meeting to which members of the BLF spoke. There were over 600 people turned up at the public meeting. And the New South Wales BLF, I think it was the 2nd of June 1971, placed a black ban on Kelly's Bush, the development of Kelly's Bush. Now, interestingly, A.V. Jennings said that if you placed a black ban, we will use scab labour to redevelop luxurious homes, to develop luxurious homes on Kelly's Bush. The BLF said that if you destroy one tree, we will make sure that any A.V. Jennings project we are currently working on, we will stop work and it will be a monument to your destruction. Eventually, the local council, I think it was Hunters Hill Council, bought out A.V. Jennings and Kelly's Bush was saved for future generations. By 1973, there were over 42 green bans placed on developments, mainly in Sydney, by the New South Wales BLF. As I said before, they included bans on demolishing public housing. As the New South Wales BLF said, we are not against development. We are for sustainable development. We are for development which benefits the local community. We don't want to see the local community evicted and a mass of office blocks opened up. So in 1973, the term green ban, the term green ban was introduced. Now, the Sydney BLF, or the New South Wales BLF, was not just about working with residents' action groups. They didn't go into a particular situation without an invitation. They required a residence action, you know, the formation of a residence action group. And these residence action groups became quite powerful over a period of time because the BLF had real power at the point of production. The riggers, the dogmen, the concreters, the scaffolders had real power at the point of production. New South Wales BLF became a hub of radical activity, especially in Sydney. And the green bands were used to radicalise the middle classes. They were about public transport, low-cost housing, prisoners' rights, urban Aboriginal and rights, land rights. I'll give you a few examples. The BLF placed a ban, a green ban, on Sydney University until it introduced women studies. The BLF placed a ban on Macquarie University in 1973, was described as the first pink ban, because they wanted to expel a student who was gay from housing, student housing. The New South Wales BLF was involved in the struggle to ensure that Redfern continued to be the base of urban Aboriginality. What happened is when I think it was IBF bought a number of homes in Redfern which were to be redeveloped as private housing, the BLF, the New South Wales BLF, placed a green ban, well at that time it was called a black ban, on the redevelopment. Now you've got to remember, this is a period when the Whitlam-led Labor government was in power. And although New South Wales governments were agog at the power that the BLF was able to exercise and the power that residents' action groups were able to exercise because of their association with the BLF, the New South Wales BLF, the fact was, because there was a reformist Labor government in power, no legislation was passed to curb the actions of the New South Wales BLF. And we've got to the situation where in suburbs like Woolloomooloo and the Rocks, where the developers will put up a plan, the resident action group would put up a plan, and eventually there'd be a compromise plan which suited both sides. And the only reason this would occur is because the BLF, the New South Wales BLF, had real power at the point of production. So what happened? Now, there had always been competition between the Sydney-based BLF, which was dominated to some extent by the Euro-communists in the New South Wales Communist Party of Australia, and the Marx and the Stalinist hardliners, or the Maoist hardliners, in the CPA Marxist-Leninist, which was led by Norm Gallagher. In 1974, we saw one of the most treacherous acts that has occurred in trade union history. The Victorian branch, which was the federal executive, intervened in the activities of the New South Wales BLF. They sent up carloads of Victorian BLF members to take over the BLF and to introduce a new ticket, a federal ticket to work. I mean, the New South Wales BLF had introduced a no ticket, no work policy, but that was based on a New South Wales ticket. Now, the Melbourne-based BLF, at the behest of the Master Builders Association in New South Wales, took over the branch, violently took over the branch. We also passed resolutions which ensured that Mundy, Owens and Pringle and other members of the executive of the New South Wales-based BLF would never get a federal ticket. They took their exclusion to court. They won their court case, but it made no difference because the Masters Builders Association and the federal BLF had worked together to destroy the New South Wales BLF. And the first thing that occurred is that a large number of green bans in New South Wales were rescinded. So once again, we saw how treachery is the mechanism by which more radical, inclusive, democratic elements of the trade union movement are destroyed by the fossilised remains of people who think they're in power for generations. Now, those of you who are old enough will remember as the 70s turned to the 80s that the Hawke Labor government was elected. And it was elected on the platform of a coalition of unions and employers and government. And the great losers in this coalition were obviously the unions. And we saw in 1986, quite interestingly, we saw in 1986 that the federal BLF was outlawed by the Hawke-led Labor government. So here we see the sharp division between the trade union movement and Labor governments, where more conservative elements in the trade union movement and Labor governments work together to maintain the status quo. And today, in 2026, James Strater would be turning in his grave. Because what we've seen since 1986 is a whole platform of legislation which has basically destroyed the ability of the trade union movement to represent their members, let alone become involved in activities, socially responsible activities. And we saw this recently in Melbourne, where the Barrack Beacon Public Housing Estate was privatised by the Victorian Labor government and the Victorian construction branch of the CFMEU was not interested in placing a green ban on that development. Because since the destruction of the New South Wales BLF, trade unions have basically concentrated on looking after the interest of a shrinking number of members. Now, in the 70s, over 60%, I think it was 65% of Australians belonged to a trade union. Today, less than 12% belong to a trade union, and most of those trade unionists are in the public sector, whether it's the state public sector or the federal public sector. But what's important is we have now seen the introduction of legislation which makes it impossible for trade unions to withdraw their labour. Now, I know everybody loves to talk about communist, you know, China and Russia and other parts in the world where there are no trade unions or their trade unions have been tamed by the government of the day. But it's the same story in Australia. In Australia, in 2026, it is illegal for a worker to withdraw their labour outside an enterprising bargaining agreement period and only when the Fair Work Commission allows them to withdraw their labour. You can be jailed for up to 25 years for occupying your workplace. Occupations of workplaces in the 70s and early 80s were a common feature via which workers improved their situation. We now have trade unions, which are trade unionists who are basically now considered to be a little better than criminals. We see intervention in the construction division of the CFMEU. We have seen the imposition of legislation which makes picket lines by union members illegal. We have seen legislation enacted which fines individual members of trade unions who take unauthorised industrial action can be fined up to $10,000 a day, and the trade union isn't able to pay that fine. We have seen individual members of unions denied access to major sites to look after the interests of their members. So what we've seen in the last 40 years since the election of the Whitlam-led Labor government, since the election of the Hawke-led Labor government, what we have seen is the destruction of the ability of wage earners to combine in order to improve their situation, let alone be involved in activity, socially progressive activity in the community. For example, as I said, the New South Wales BLF was involved in anti-Vietnam War struggle, involved in public housing struggle, environmental struggle, Aboriginal rights struggle, gay rights struggle, women's rights struggle, all within 71 to 74, a glorious three-year period. And that only occurred because the Whitlam-led Labor government was in power and was unwilling to be pushed around and pass legislation to destroy this emerging union, which a socially responsible trade union movement. They had to rely on the Stalinists from the federal executive, Victorian federal executive, to intervene in the New South Wales division and take it over in order to break their power. So, what we find in 2026, as I said before, is we see James Strater turning in his grave. James Strater was sentenced to 500 lashes, 1 month on bread and water in solitary confinement, and he had to serve the rest of his sentence in a penal colony for the crime of inciting his master's servants to combine to oblige him to improve their wages and conditions. Today, in 2026, we have legislation in place which criminalises trade union activity. We have legislation where individual workers can be fined $10,000 a day for striking outside an enterprise bargaining agreement period. We have legislation which sees the intervention of authorities in the activities of trade unionists. We see legislation which can jail people for up to 25 years for being involved in a workplace occupation. We see legislation which denies trade unions the ability to go onto a work site to look after their members' interests. We even saw legislation a few years ago which prevented the Eureka flag from being flown on building sites. An extraordinary situation. It's an extraordinary situation. Trade unionism has been destroyed. It has been destroyed because of political ideology, which was concerned about the fact that, as I discussed before, the New South Wales BLF was involved in a new type of trade unionism. So thank you for listening to The Anarchist World this week on your local community radio station. This program was pre-recorded. Next week's program will be pre-recorded, but I'll be back on the first week in March. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World this week on your local community radio station.
evil minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death's construction.
An analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Anarchist World This Week. Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. 10 a.m. every Wednesday. Listen to the Anarchist World This Week for an up-to-date analysis of local, national and international events.
Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.